sides of the spiral staircase. Juliet made a noise in her throat, a raw cry of desperation, of effort. She pawed through the water, fighting the sinking of the suit, and grasped the railing of the submerged stairway. Pulling herself up and kicking off of the railing, she made it to the nearest shimmer of bubbles, grabbed the edge of the stairs, and pushed her mouth right up to the metal underside of the step. She inhaled a desperate gasp of air and sucked in a lot of water in the process. She ducked her head below the step and coughed into the water, which brought the burn of fluids invading her nose. She nearly sucked in a lungful of water, felt her heart racing and ready to burst out of her chest, stuck her face back up against the wet, rusty underside of the step, and her lips pursed and trembling, managed to take in a gentle sip of air. The tiny flashes of light in her vision subsided. She lowered her head and blew out, away from the step, watching the bubbles of her exhalation rise, and then pressed her face close for another taste. Air. She blinked away underwater tears of effort, of frustration, of relief. Peering up the twisted maze of metal steps, many of them moving like flexible mirrors where the trapped air was stirred by her mad gyrations, she saw a pathway like no other. She kicked off and took a few steps at a time, pulling herself hand over hand in the gaps between, drinking tiny bubbles of air out of the inches-deep hollow beneath each tread, praising the tight welds where the diamond plate steps had been joined many hundreds of years ago. The steps had been boxed in for strength, to handle the traffic of a million impacts of boots, and now they held the gaseous overflow from her descent. Her lips brushed each one, tasting metal and rust, kissing her salvation. The green emergency lights all around her remained steady, so Juliet never noticed the landings drifting past. She just concentrated on taking 5 steps with each breath, 6 steps, a long stretch with hardly any air, another mouthful of water where the bubble was too thin to breathe, a lifetime of rising against the tug of her flooded suit and dangling tools, no thought for stopping and cutting things free, just kick and pull, hand over hand, up the undersides of the steps, a deep and steady pull of air, suck this shallow step dry, don't exhale into the steps above, easy now. 5 more steps. It was a game, like hop, 5 squares in a leap, don't cheat, mind the chalk, she was good at this, getting better. And then a foul burn on her lips, the taste of water growing toxic, her head coming up into the underside of a step and breaking through a film of gas stench and slimy oil. Juliet blew out her last breath and coughed, wiping at her face, her head still trapped below the next step. She wheezed and laughed and pushed herself away, banging her head on the sharp steel edge of the stairs. She was free. She briefly bobbed below the surface as she swam around the railing, her eyes burning from the oil and gas floating on top. Splashing loudly, crying for solo, she made it over the railing. With her padded and shivering knees, she finally found the steps. She'd survived. Clinging to the dry treads above her, neck bent, gasping and wheezing, her legs numb, she tried to cry out that she'd made it. But it escaped as a whimper. She was cold, she was freezing. Her arms shivered as she pulled herself up the quiet steps, no rattle from the compressor, no arms reaching to assist her. Solo? She crawled the half dozen treads to the landing and rolled onto her back. Some of her tools were caught on steps below, tugging at her where they were tied to her pockets. Water drained out of her suit and splashed down her neck, pooled by her head, ran into her ears. She turned her head, she needed to get this freezing suit off, and found Solo. He was lying on his side, eyes shut, blood running down his face, some of it already caked dry. Solo? Her hand was a shivering blur as she reached out and shook him. What had he done to himself? Hey, wake the fuck up! Her teeth were chattering. She grabbed his shoulder and gave him a violent shake. Solo, I need help! One of his eyes parted a little. He blinked a few times, then bent double and coughed, blood flecking the landing by his face. Help, she said. She fumbled for the zipper at her back, not realizing it was Solo who needed her. Solo coughed into his hand, then rolled over and settled once again on his back. The blood on his head was still flowing from somewhere, fresh tracks trickling across what had dried some time before. Solo? He groaned. Juliet pulled herself closer, could barely feel her body. He whispered something, his voice a rasp on the edge of silence. Hey. She brought her face close to his. Could feel her lips swollen and numb. Could still taste the gasoline.
Not my name.
He coughed a mist of red. One arm lifted from the landing a few inches as if to cover his mouth, but it never had a chance of getting there.
Not my name,
he said again. His head lolled side to side, and Juliet finally realized that he was badly injured. Her mind began to clear enough to see what state he was in.
Hold still, she groaned. Solo, I need you to be still.
She tried to push herself up, to will herself the strength to move. Solo blinked and looked at her, his eyes glassy, blood tinting the gray in his beard crimson.
Not Solo,
he said, his voice straining.
My name's Jimmy.
More coughing, his eyes rolling up into the back of his head.
And I don't think...
His eyelids sagged shut and then squinted in pain.
Don't think I was...
Stay with me,
Juliet said, hot tears cutting down her frozen face.
Don't think I ever was alone,
he whispered, the lines on his face relaxing, his head sagging to the cold steel landing. 70. Silo 18. The pot on the stove bubbled noisily, steam rising off the surface, tiny drops of water leaping to their freedom over the edge. Lucas shook a pinch of tea leaves out of the resealable tin and into the tiny strainer. His hands were shaking as he lowered the little basket into his mug. As he lifted the pot, some water spilled directly on the burner. The drops made spitting sounds and gave off a burned odor. He watched Bernard out of the corner of his eye as he tilted the boiling water through the leaves.
I just don't understand, he said, holding the mug with both hands, allowing the heat to penetrate his palms. How could you do something like this on purpose?
He shook his head and peered into his mug, where a few intrepid shreds of leaf had already gotten free and swam outside the basket. He looked up at Bernard.
And you knew about this? How? How could you know about this?
Bernard frowned. He rubbed his mustache with one hand, the other resting in the belly of his overalls.
I wish I didn't know it, he told Lucas. And now you see why some facts, some pieces of knowledge, have to be snuffed out as soon as they form. Curiosity would blow across such embers and burn this silo to the ground.
He looked down at his boots.
I pieced it together much as you did, just knowing what we have to know to do this job. This is why I chose you, Lucas. You and a few others have some idea what's stored on these servers. You're already prepped for learning more. Can you imagine if you told any of this to someone who wears red or green to work every day?
Lucas shook his head.
It's happened before, you know. Silo 10 went down like that. I sat back there. He pointed toward the small study with the books, the computer, the hissing radio. And I listened to it happen. I listened to a colleague's shadow broadcast his insanity to anyone who would listen.
Lucas studied his steeping tea. A handful of leaves swam about on hot currents of darkening water. The rest remained in the grip of the imprisoning basket.
That's why the radio controls are locked up, he said. And it's why you are locked up.
Lucas nodded. He'd already suspected as much.
How long were you kept in here?
He glanced up at Bernard, and an image flashed in his mind. One of Sheriff Billings inspecting his gun while his mother had visited him. Had they been listening in? Would he have been shot, his mother too, if he'd said anything?
I spent just over 2 months down here until my caster knew I was ready, that I'd accepted and understood everything I'd learned.
He crossed his arms over his belly.
I really wish you hadn't asked the question, hadn't put it together so soon. It's much better to find out when you're older.
Lucas pursed his lips and nodded. It was strange to talk like this with someone his senior, someone who knew so much more, was so much wiser. He imagined this was the sort of conversation a man had with his father, only not about the planned and carried out destruction of the entire world. Lucas bent his head and breathed in the smell of the steeping leaves. The mint was like a direct line through the trembling stress, a strike to the calm pleasure center in the deep regions of his brain. He inhaled and held his breath, finally let it out. Bernard crossed to the small stove in the corner of the storeroom and started making his own mug.
How did they do it? Lucas asked. To kill so many. Do you know how they did it?
Bernard shrugged. He tapped the tin with one finger,
shaking out a precise amount of tea into another basket.
They might still be doing it for all I know. Nobody talks about how long it's supposed to go on. There's fear that small pockets of survivors might be holed up elsewhere around the globe. Operation 50 is completely pointless if anyone else survives. The population has to be homogeneous.
The man I spoke to, he said we were it. Just the 50 silos.
47, Bernard said. And we are it, as far as we know. It's difficult to imagine anyone else being so well prepared. But there's always a chance. It's only been a few hundred years.
A few hundred? Lucas leaned back against the counter. He lifted his tea, but the mint was losing its power to reach him. So hundreds of years ago we decided—
They.
Bernard filled his mug with the still steaming water.
They decided. Don't include yourself. Certainly don't include me.
Okay, they decided to destroy the world. Wipe everything out. Why? Bernard set his mug down on the stove to let it steep.
He pulled off his glasses, wiped the steam off them, then pointed them toward the study, toward the wall with the massive shelves of books.
Because of the worst parts of our legacy, that's why. At least, that's what I think they would say if they were still alive.
He lowered his voice and muttered,
Which they aren't, thank God.
Lucas shuddered. He still didn't believe anyone would make that decision, no matter what the conditions were like. He thought of the billions of people who supposedly lived beneath the stars all those hundreds of years ago. Nobody could kill so many. How could anyone take that much life for granted? And now we work for them, Lucas spat. He crossed to the sink and pulled the basket out of his mug, set it on the stainless steel to drain. He took a cautious sip, slurping lest it burn him. You tell me not to include us, but we're a part of this now.
No.
Bernard walked away from the stove and stood in front of the small map of the world hanging above the dinette.
We weren't any part of what those crazy fucks did. If I had those guys, the men who did this, if I had them in a room with me, I'd kill every last goddamn one of them.
Bernard smacked the map with his palm.
I'd kill them with my bare hands.
Lucas didn't say anything. He didn't move.
They didn't give us a chance. That's not what this is.
He gestured at the room around him.
These are prisons. Cages, not homes. Not meant to protect us, but meant to force us, by pain of death, to bring about their vision.
Their vision for what?
For a world where we're too much the same. Where we're too tightly invested in each other to waste our time fighting. To waste our resources guarding those same limited resources.
He lifted his mug and took a noisy sip.
That's my theory, at least, from decades of reading. The people who did this, they were in charge of a powerful country that was beginning to crumble. They could see the end, their end, and it scared them suicidal. As the time began to run out, over decades, keep in mind, they figured they had one chance to preserve themselves, to preserve what they saw as their way of life. And so before they lost the only opportunity they might ever have, they put a plan into motion.
Without anybody knowing? How? Bernard took another sip. He smacked his lips and wiped his mustache.
Who knows? Maybe nobody could believe it anyway. Maybe the reward for secrecy was inclusion. They built other things in factories bigger than you can imagine that nobody knew about. They built bombs in factories like these that I suspect played a part in all this, all without anyone knowing. And there are stories in the legacy about men from a long time ago in a land with great kings, like mayors, but with many more people to rule. When these men died, elaborate chambers were built below the earth and filled with treasure. It required the work of hundreds of men. Do you know how they kept the location of these chambers a secret?
Lucas lifted his shoulders. They paid the workers a ton of chits?
Bernard laughed.
He pinched a stray tea leaf off his tongue.
They didn't have chits. And no, they made perfectly sure these men would keep quiet. They killed them.
Their own men? Lucas glanced toward the room with the books, wondering which tin this story was in.
It is not beyond us to kill to keep secrets.
Bernard's face hardened as he said this.
It'll be a part of your job one day when you take over.
Lucas felt a sharp pain in his gut as the truth of this hit. He caught the first glimmer of what he truly signed on for.
It made shooting people with rifles seem an honest affair. We are not the people who made this world, Lucas, but it's up to us to survive it. You need to understand that.
We can't control where we are right now, he mumbled. Just what we do going forward.
Wise words.
Bernard took another sip of tea. Yeah, I'm just beginning to appreciate them.
Bernard set his cup in the sink and tucked a hand in the round belly of his overalls.
He stared at Lucas a moment, then looked again to the small map of the world.
Evil men did this, but they're gone. Forget them. Just know this. They locked up their brood as a fucked-up form of their own survival. They put us in this game, a game where breaking the rules means we all die, every single one of us. But living by those rules, obeying them, means we all suffer.
He adjusted his glasses and walked over to Lucas, patted him on the shoulder as he went past.
I'm proud of you, son. You're absorbing this much better than I ever did. Now get some rest. Make some room in your head and heart. Tomorrow, more studies.
He headed toward the study, the corridor, the distant ladder. Lucas nodded and remained silent. He waited until Bernard was gone, the muted clang of distant metal telling him that the grate was back in place, before walking through to the study to gaze up at the big schematic, the one with the silos crossed out. He peered at the roof of Silo 1, wondering just who in hell was in charge of all this, and whether they too could rationalize their actions as having been foisted upon them, imagine themselves as not really being culpable, but just going along with something they'd inherited. A crooked game with ratchet rules, and almost everyone kept ignorant and locked up. Where the fuck were these people? Could he see himself being one of them? How did Bernard not see that he was one of them? 71. Silo 18. The door to the generator room slammed shut behind her, dulling the patter of gunfire to a distant hammering. Shirley ran toward the control room on sore legs, ignoring her friends and co-workers asking her what was going on outside. They cowered along the walls and behind the railing from the loud blast and the sporadic gunfire. Just before she reached the control room, she noticed some workers from second shift on top of the main generator toying with the rumbling machine's massive exhaust system. I got it, Shirley wheezed, slamming the control room door shut behind her. Courtney and Walker looked up from the floor. The wide eyes and slack-jawed Courtney's face told Shirley she'd missed something. What? She asked. She handed the two transmitters to Walker. Did you hear? Walk, does she know? How's this possible? Courtney asked. How did she survive? And what happened to your face? Shirley touched her lip, her sore chin. Her fingers came away wet with blood. She used the sleeve of her undershirt to dab at her mouth.
If this works, Walker grumbled, fiddling with one of the transmitters. We can ask Jules herself.
Shirley turned and peered through the control room's observation window. She lowered her sleeve away from her face. What's Carl and them doing with the exhaust feed? She asked. They've got some plan to reroute it, Courtney said. She got up from the floor while Walker started soldering something, the smell reminding her of his workshop. He grumbled about his eyesight while Courtney joined her by the glass. Reroute it where? IT. That's what Helene said anyway. The cooling feed for their server room runs through the ceiling here before shooting up the mechanical shaft. Someone spotted the proximity on a schematic, thought of a way to fight back from here. So we choke them out with our fumes? Shirley felt uneasy about the plan. She wondered what Knox would say if he were still alive, still in charge. Surely all the men and women riding desks up there weren't the problem. Walk, how long before we can talk? Before we can try and contact her?
Almost there. Blasted magnifiers.
Courtney rested her hand on Shirley's arm. Are you okay? How are you holding up? Me? Shirley laughed and shook her head. She checked the bloodstains on her sleeve, felt the sweat trickling down her chest. I'm walking around in shock. I have no idea what the hell's going on anymore. My ears are still ringing from whatever they did to the stairwell. I think I've screwed up my ankle, and I'm starving. Oh, and did I mention my friend isn't as dead as I thought she was? She took a deep breath. Courtney continued to stare at her worryingly. Shirley knew none of this was what her friend was asking her about. And yeah, I miss Mark, she said quietly. Courtney put her arm around her friend and pulled her close. I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to. Shirley waved her off. The two of them stood quietly and watched through the window as a small crew from second shift worked on the generator, trying to reroute the outpouring of noxious fumes from the apartment-sized machine to the floors of the 30s high above. You know what, though? There are times when I'm glad he's not here. Times when I know I won't be around much longer either. Not once they get to us. And I'm glad he's not here to stress about it, to worry about what they'll do to us, to me. And I'm glad I haven't had to watch him do all this fighting, living on rations, this sort of craziness. She dipped her chin at the crew outside. She knew Mark would have been either up there leading that terrible work or outside with a gun pressed to his cheek.
Hello? Testing? Hello? Hello?
The two women turned around to see Walker clicking the red detonate switch, the microphone from the headset held beneath his chin, furrows of concentration across his brow.
Juliet? He asked. Can you hear me? Hello?
Shirley moved to Walker's side, squatted down, rested a hand on his shoulder. The three of them stared at the headphones, waiting for a reply.
Hello?
A quiet voice leaked out of the tiny speakers. Shirley clapped a hand to her chest, her breath stolen from the miracle of a reply. It was a fraction of a second later, after the surge of desperate hope, that she realized this wasn't Juliet. The voice was different.
That's not her, Courtney whispered, dejected.
Walker waved his hand to silence her. The red switch clicked noisily as he prepared to transmit.
Hello, my name is Walker. We received a transmission from a friend. Is there anyone else there?
Ask them where they are, Courtney hissed.
Where exactly are you?
Walker added, before releasing the switch. The tiny speakers popped.
We are nowhere. You'll never find us. Stay away.
There was a pause, a hiss of static.
And your friend is dead. We killed him.
72. Silo 17. The water inside the suit was freezing, the air cold, the combination lethal. Juliet's teeth chattered noisily while she worked the knife. She slid the blade into the soggy skin of the suit, the feeling of having already been here, having done all this before, unmistakable. The gloves came off first, the suit destroyed, water pouring out of every cut. Juliet rubbed her hands together, could barely feel them. She hacked away at the material over her chest, her eyes falling to Solo, who had gone deathly still. His large wrench was missing, she saw. Their supply bag was gone as well. The compressor was on its side, the hose kinked beneath it, fuel leaking from the loose filling cap. Juliet was freezing. She could hardly breathe. Once the chest of the suit was cut open, she wiggled her knees and feet through the hole, spun the material around in front of herself, then tried to pry the Velcro apart. Her fingers were too senseless even to do this. She ran the knife down the joint instead, sawing the Velcro apart until she could find the zipper. Finally, squeezing her fingers until they were white, she pulled the small tab free of the collar and threw the suit away from herself. The thing weighed double with all the water in it. She was left in two layers of black undersuit, still soaking wet and shivering, a knife in her trembling hand, the body of a good man lying beside her, a man who had survived everything this nasty world could throw at him, except for her arrival. Juliet moved to Solo's side and reached for his neck. Her hands were icy. She couldn't feel a pulse, wasn't sure if she would be able to. She could barely feel his neck with her frozen fingers. She struggled to her feet, nearly collapsed, hugged the landing's railing. She teetered toward the compressor, knowing she needed to warm up. She felt the powerful urge to go to sleep, but knew she'd never wake up if she did. The fuel can was still full. She tried to work the cap, but her hands were useless. They were numb and vibrating from the cold. Her breath fogged in front of her, a chilly reminder of the heat she was losing, what little heat she had left. She grabbed the knife. Holding it in both hands, she pressed the tip into the cap. The flat handle was easier to grasp than the plastic cup. She spun the knife and cracked the lid on the jug of fuel. Once the cap was loose, she pulled the blade out and did the rest with her palms, the knife resting in her lap. She tilted the can over the compressor, soaking the large rubber wheels, the carriage, the entire motor. She would never want to use it again anyway, never rely on it or anything else for her air. She put the can down, still half full, and slid it away from the compressor with her foot. Fuel dripped through the metal grating and made musical impacts in the water below, drips that echoed off the concrete walls of the stairwell and added to the flood's toxic and colorful slick. Wielding the knife with the blade down, the dull side away from her, she smacked it against the metal fins of the heat exchanger. She yanked her arm back with each strike, expecting the whoosh of an immediate flame. But there was no spark. She hit it harder, hating to abuse her precious tool, her only defense. Solo's stillness nearby was a reminder that she might need it if she were able to survive the deadly cold. The knife struck with a snick, and there was a pop, heat traveling up her arm, a wash of it against her face. Juliet dropped the knife and waved her hand, but it wasn't on fire. The compressor was. Part of the grating, too. As it began to die down, she grabbed the can and sloshed some more fuel out of it, large balls of orange flame rewarding her, leaping up in the air with a whoosh. The wheels crackled as they burned. Juliet collapsed close to the fire, felt the heat from the dancing flame as it burned all across the metal machine. She began to strip, her eyes returning now and then to Solo, promising herself that she wouldn't leave his body there, that she would come back for him. Feeling returned to her extremities, at first gradually, but then with a tingling pain. Naked, she curled into a ball next to the small and feeble fire and rubbed her hands together, breathing her warm and visible breath into her palms. Twice she had to feed the hungry and stingy fire. Only the wheels burned reliably, but they kept her from needing another spark. The glorious heat traveled somewhat through the landing's grated decking, warming her bare skin where it touched the metal. Her teeth chattered violently. Juliet eyed the stairs, this new fear coursing through her that boots could rumble down at any moment, that she was trapped between these other survivors and the freezing water. She retrieved her knife, held it in front of her with both hands, tried to will herself not to shiver so violently. Glimpses of her face in the blade caused her to worry more. She looked as pale as a ghost, lips purple, eyes ringed dark and seeming hollow. She nearly laughed at the sight of her lips vibrating, the clacking blur of her teeth. She scooted closer to the fire. The orange light danced on the blade, the unburned fuel dripping and forming silvery splashes of color below. As the last of the gas burned and the flames dwindled, Juliet decided to move. She was still shaking, but it was cold in the depths of the shaft, so far from the electricity of IT. She patted the black underlinings she'd stripped off. One of them had been left balled up and was still soaked. The other she had at least dropped flat. If she'd been thinking clearly, she would have hung it up. It was damp, but better to wear it and heat it up herself than allow the cold air to wick her body temperature away. She worked her legs in, struggled to get her arms through the sleeves, zipped up the front. On bare, numb, and unsteady feet, she returned to Solo. She could feel his neck this time. He felt warm. She couldn't remember how long a body stayed that way. And then she felt a weak and slow thrumming in his neck. A beat. Solo! She shook his shoulders. Hey! What name had he whispered? She remembered. Jimmy! His head lolled from side to side while she shook his shoulder. She checked his scalp beneath all that crazy hair, saw lots of blood. Most of it was dry. She looked around again for her bag. They had brought food, water, and dry clothes for when she got back up, but the satchel was gone. She grabbed her other undersuit instead. She wasn't sure about the quality of the water in the fabric, but it had to be better than nothing. Wrenching the material in a tight ball, she dripped what she could against his lips. She squeezed more on his head, brushed his hair back to inspect the wound, probed the nasty cut with her fingers. As soon as the water hit the open gash, it was like pushing a button. Solo lurched to the side, away from her hand and the drip from the undersuit. His teeth flashed yellow in his beard as he screamed in pain, his hands rising from the landing and hovering there, arms tensed, still senseless. Solo, hey, it's okay. She held him as he came to, his eyes rolling around, lids blinking. It's okay, she said. You're gonna be okay. She used the balled up undersuit to dab at his wound. Solo grunted and held her wrist but didn't pull away.
Stings, he said.
He blinked and looked around.
Where am I?
The down deep, she reminded him, happy to hear him talking. She felt like crying with relief.
I think you were attacked.
He tried to sit up, hissing between his teeth, a powerful grip pinching her wrist.
Easy, she said, trying to hold him down. You've got a nasty cut on your head, a lot of swelling.
His body relaxed.
Where are they?
He asked.
I don't know, Juliet said. What do you remember? How many were there?
He closed his eyes. She continued to dab at his wound.
Just one, I think.
He opened his eyes wide as if shocked by the memory of the attack.
He was my age.
We need to get up top, she told him. We need to get where it's warm, get you cleaned up, get me dry. Do you think you can move?
I'm not crazy, Solo said.
I know you're not.
The thing is, it moved. The lights. It wasn't me. I'm not crazy.
No,
Juliet agreed. She remembered all the times she had thought the same thing of herself, always in the down deep of this place, usually while rummaging around supply.
You aren't crazy,
she said, comforting him. You aren't crazy at all. 73. Silo 18. Lucas couldn't force himself to study, not what he was supposed to be studying. The order sat flopped open on the wooden desk, the little lamp on its thousand-jointed neck bent over and warming it in a pool of light. He stood before the wall schematics instead, staring at the arrangement of silos, which were spaced out like the servers in the room above him, and listened to the radio crackle with the sounds of distant warring. The final push was being made. Sims's team had lost a few men in an awful explosion, something about a stairwell, but not the great stairwell, and now they were in a fight they hoped would be the last. The little speakers by the radio crackled with static as the men coordinated themselves, as Bernard shouted orders from his office one level up, always with the crackle of gunfire erupting behind the voices. Lucas knew he shouldn't listen, and yet he couldn't stop. Juliet would call him any time now and ask him for an update. She would want to know what had happened, how the end had come, and the only thing worse than telling her would be admitting he didn't know, that he couldn't bear to listen. He reached out and touched the round roof of Silo 17. It was as though he were a god surveying the structures from up high. He pictured his hand piercing the dark clouds above Juliet and spanning a roof built for thousands. He rubbed his fingers over the red X drawn across the silo, those two slashes that admitted to such a great loss. The marks felt waxy beneath his fingers, like they'd been drawn with crayon or something similar. He tried to imagine getting the news one day that an entire people were gone, wiped out. He would have to dig in Bernard's desk, his desk, and find the red stick, cross out another chance at their legacy, another pod of buried hope. Lucas looked up at the overhead lights, steady and constant, unblinking. Why hadn't she called? His fingernail caught on one of the red marks and flaked a piece of it away. The wax stuck under his fingernail, the paper beneath still stained blood red. There was no taking it back, no cleaning it off, no making it whole again. Gunfire erupted from the radio. Lucas went to the shelf where the little unit was mounted and listened to orders being barked, men being killed. His forehead went clammy with sweat. He knew how that felt, to pull that trigger, to end a life. He was conscious of an emptiness in his chest and a weakness in his knees. Lucas steadied himself with the shelf, palms slick, and looked at the transmitter hanging there inside its locked cage. How he longed to call those men and tell them not to do it, to stop all the insanity, the violence, the pointless killing. There could be a red X on them all. This was what they should fear, not each other. He touched the metal cage that kept the radio controls locked away from him, feeling the truth of this and the silliness of broadcasting it to everyone else. It was naive. It wouldn't change anything. The short-term rage to be sated at the end of a barrel was too easy to act on. Staving off extinction required something else, something with more vision, something impossibly patient. His hand drifted across the metal grating. He peered inside at one of the dials, the arrow pointing to the number 18. There were 50 numbers in a dizzying circle, one for each silo. Lucas gave the cage a futile tug, wishing he could listen to something else. What was going on in all those other distant lands? Harmless things, probably. Jokes and chatter, gossip. He could imagine the thrill of breaking in on one of those conversations and introducing himself to people who weren't in the know. I am Lucas from Silo 18, he might say. And they would want to know why silos had numbers. And Lucas would tell them to be good to each other. That there were only so many of them left, and that all the books and all the stars in the universe were pointless with no one to read them, no one to peer through the parting clouds for them. He left the radio alone, left it to its war, and walked past the desk and its eager pool of light spilling across that dreary book. He checked the tins for something that might hold his attention. He felt restless, pacing like a pig in its pen. He knew he should go for another jog among the servers, but that would mean showering, and somehow showering had begun to feel like an insufferable chore. Crouching down at the far end of the shelves, he sorted through the loose, untinned stacks of paper there. Here was where the handwritten notes and the additions to the legacy had amassed over the years. Notes to future silo leaders, instructions, manuals, mementos. He pulled out the generator control room manual, the one Juliet had written. He had watched Bernard shelve the papers weeks ago, saying it might come in handy if the problems in the down deep went from bad to worse. And the radio was blasting the worse. Lucas went to his desk and bent the neck of the lamp so he could read the handwriting inside. There were days that he dreaded her calling, dreaded getting caught, or Bernard answering, or her asking him to do things he couldn't, things he would never do again. And now with the light steady overhead, nothing buzzing, all he wanted was a call. His chest ached for it. Some part of him knew that what she was doing was dangerous, that something bad could have happened. She was living beneath the red X, after all, a mark that meant death for anyone below it. The pages of the manual were full of notes she'd made with sharp lead. He rubbed one of them, feeling the grooves with his fingers. The actual content was inscrutable. Settings for dials in every conceivable order, valve positions, electrical diagrams. Riffling through the pages, he saw the manual as a project not unlike his star charts, created by a mind not unlike his own. This awareness made the distance between them worse. Why couldn't they go back? Back to before the cleaning, before the string of burials. She would get off work every night and come sit with him while he gazed into the darkness, thinking and watching, chatting and waiting. He turned the manual around and read some of the printed words from the play, which were nearly as indecipherable. In the margins sat notes from a different hand. Lucas assumed Juliet's mother, or maybe one of the actors. There were diagrams on some pages, little arrows showing movement. An actor's notes, he decided. Directions on a stage. The play must have been a souvenir to Juliet, this woman he had feelings for whose name was in the title. He scanned the lines, looking for something poetic to capture his dark mood. As the text flowed by, his eyes caught a brief flash of familiar scrawl, not the actor's. He flipped back, looking for it a page at a time until he found it. It was Juliet's hand, no mistaking. He moved the play into the light so he could read the faded marks. George, there you lay, so serene. The wrinkles in your brow and by your eyes, nowhere seen. A touch when others look away, look for a clue, but only I know what happened to you. Wait for me, wait for me, wait there, my dear. Let these gentle pleas find your ear and bury them there, so this stolen kiss can grow on the quiet love that no other shall know. Lucas felt a cold rod pierce his chest. He felt his longing replaced by a flash of temper. Who was this George? A childhood fling? Juliet was never in a sanctioned relationship. He had checked the official records the day after they'd met. Access to the servers afforded certain guilty powers. A crush, perhaps? Some man in mechanical who was already in love with another girl? To Lucas, this would have been even worse. A man she longed for in a way she never would feel for him. Was that why she'd taken a job so far from home? To get away from the sight of this George she couldn't have? These feelings she'd hidden in the margins of a play about forbidden love? He turned and plopped down in front of Bernard's computer. Shaking the mouse, he logged into the upstairs servers remotely, his cheeks feeling flush with this sick feeling, this new feeling, knowing it was called jealousy, but unfamiliar with the heady rush that came with it. He navigated to the personnel files and searched the down deep for George. There were four hits. He copied the ID number of each and put them in a text file, then fed them to the ID department. While the pictures of each popped up, he skimmed their records, feeling a little guilty for the abuse of power, a little worried about this discovery, and a lot less agonizingly bored having found something to do. Only one of the Georges worked in mechanical, older guy. As the radio crackled behind him, Lucas wondered what would become of this man if he was still down there. There was a chance that he was no longer alive, that the records were a few weeks out of date, the blockade a barrier to the truth. A couple of the hits were too young. One wasn't even a year old yet. The other was shadowing a porter. It left one man, 32 years old. He worked in the bazaar, occupation listed as other, married with two kids. Lucas studied the blurry image of him from the ID office. Mustache, receding hair, a sideways smirk. His eyes were too far apart, Lucas decided. His brows too dark and much too bushy. Lucas held up the manual and read the poem again. The man was dead, he decided. Bury these pleas. He did another search, this time a global one that included the closed records. Hundreds of hits throughout the silo popped up, names from all the way back to the uprising. This did not dissuade Lucas. He knew Juliet was 34, and so he gave her an 18-year window. Figured if she were younger than 16 when she'd had this crush, he wouldn't stress. He would let go of the envious and shameful burn inside him. From the list of Georges, There were only 3 deaths in the down deep for the 18-year period. One was in his 50s, the other in his 60s. Both died of natural causes. Lucas thought to cross-reference them with Juliet, see if there'd been any work relations, if they shared a family tree, perhaps. And then he saw the third file. This was his George. Her George. Lucas knew it. Doing the math, Lucas saw he would be 38 if he were still alive. He had died just over 3 years earlier, had worked in mechanical, had never married. He ran the ID search, and the picture confirmed his fears. He was a handsome man, a square jaw, a wide nose, dark eyes. He was smiling at the camera, calm, relaxed. It was hard to hate the man, difficult especially since he was dead. Lucas checked the cause and saw that it was investigated and then listed as an industrial accident. Investigated. He remembered hearing something about Jules when the Up Top got its new sheriff. Her qualifications had been a source of debate and tension, a wind of whispers, especially around IT. But there'd been chatter that she'd helped out on a case a long time ago, that this was why she'd been chosen. This was the case. Was she in love with him before he died? Or did she fall for the memory of the man after? He decided it had to be the former. Lucas searched the desk for a charcoal, found one, and jotted down the man's ID and case number. Here was something to occupy his time, some way of getting to know her better. It would distract him at least until she finally got around to calling him back. He relaxed, pulled the keyboard into his lap, and started digging. 74. Silo 17. Juliet shivered from the cold as she helped Solo to his feet. He wobbled and steadied himself, both hands on the railing. "Do you think you can walk?" she asked. She kept an eye on the empty stairs spiraling down toward them, wary of whoever else was out there, whoever had attacked him and nearly gotten her killed.
"I think so,"
he said. He dabbed at his forehead with his palm, studied the smear of blood he came away with.
"Don't know how far."
She guided him toward the stairs, the smell of melted rubber and gasoline stinging her nose. The black undersuit was still damp against her skin. Her breath billowed out before her, and whenever she stopped talking, her teeth chattered uncontrollably. She bent to retrieve her knife while Solo clutched the curved outer railing. Looking up, she considered the task before them. A straight run to IT seemed impossible. Her lungs were exhausted from the swim, her muscles cramped from the shivering and cold, and Solo looked even worse. His mouth was slack, his eyes drifting to and fro. He seemed barely cognizant of where he was.
"Can you make it to the deputy station?" she asked.
Juliet had spent nights there on supply runs. The holding cell made for an oddly comfortable place to sleep. The keys were still in the box. Maybe they could rest easy if they locked themselves inside and kept the key with them.
"That's how many levels?" Solo asked.
He didn't know the down deep of his own silo as well as Jules. He rarely risked venturing so far.
"A dozen or so. Can you make it?"
He lifted his boot to the first step, leaned into it.
"I can try."
They set off with only a knife between them, which Juliet was lucky to have at all. How it had survived her dark pull through mechanical was a mystery. She held it tightly, the handle cold, her hand colder. The simple cooking utensil had become her security totem, had replaced her watch as a necessary thing she must always have with her. As they made their way up the stairs, its handle clinked against the inner railing each time she reached over to steady herself. She kept her other arm around Solo, who struggled up each step with grunts and groans.
"How many of them do you think there are?"
she asked, watching his footing and then glancing nervously up the stairway. Solo grunted.
"Shouldn't be any."
He wobbled a little, but Juliet steadied him.
"All dead. Everyone."
They stopped to rest at the next landing.
"You made it," she pointed out. "All these years, and you survived?"
He frowned, wiped his beard with the back of his hand. He was breathing hard.
"But I'm Solo," he said.
He shook his head sadly.
"They were all gone. All of them."
Juliet peered up the shaft, up the gap between the stairs and the concrete. The dim green straw of the stairwell rose into a tight darkness. She pinned her teeth together to keep them from chattering while she listened for a sound, for any sign of life. Solo staggered ahead for the next flight of stairs. Juliet hurried beside him.
"How well did you see him? What do you remember?"
I remember thinking he was just like me.
Juliet thought she heard him sob, but maybe it was the exertion from tackling more of the steps. She looked back at the door they were passing, the interior dark, no power being leached from IT. Were they passing Solo's assailant? Were they leaving some living ghost behind? She powerfully hoped so. They had so much further to go, even to the deputy station, much less to any place she might call home. They trudged in silence for a level and a half, Juliet shivering and Solo grunting and wincing. She rubbed her arms now and then, could feel the sweat from the climb and from helping to steady him. It was nearly enough to warm her, but for the damp undersuit, and she was so hungry by the time they cleared three levels that she thought her body was simply going to give out. It needed fuel, something to burn and keep itself warm. "One more level and I'm going to need to stop," she told Solo. He grumbled his agreement. It felt good to have the reward of a rest as their goal. The steps were an easier climb when they were countable, finite. At the landing of 132, Solo used the railing to lower himself to the ground, hand over hand like the bars of a ladder. When his butt hit the decking, he laid out supine and folded his hands over his face. Juliet hoped it was nothing more than a concussion. She'd seen her fair share of them working around men who were too tough to wear helmets, but not so tough when a tool or a steel beam caught them on the head. There was nothing for Solo but to rest. The problem with resting was that it made her colder. Juliet stomped her feet to keep the blood circulating. The slight sweat from the hike was working against her. She could feel a draft cycling through the stairwell, cold air from below passing over the chilled waters like a natural air conditioning unit. Her shoulders shook, the knife vibrating in her hand until her reflection became a silvery blur. Moving was difficult. Staying in one place would kill her. And she still didn't know where this attacker was, could only hope he was below them. "We should get going," she told Solo. She looked at the doors beyond him, the windows dark. What would she do if someone burst out at that very moment and attacked them? What kind of fight could she hope to put up? Solo lifted his arm and waved it at her.
"Go," he said. "I'll stay."
"No, you're coming with me." She rubbed her hands together, blew on them, summoned the strength to continue. She went to Solo and tried to grab his hand, but he withdrew it.
"More rest," he said. "I'll catch up.
I'll be damned if I'm—" Her teeth clacked uncontrollably. She shivered and turned the involuntary spasm into an excuse to shake her arms, waggling them and forcing the blood to her extremities. "Damned if I'm leaving you alone," she finished.
"So thirsty," he told her.
Despite having seen quite enough water for a lifetime, Juliet was thirsty as well. She glanced up. "One more level and we're at the lower farms. Come on, that'll be far enough for today. Food and water. Find me something dry. Come on, Solo, up. I don't care if it takes us a week to get home. We aren't giving up right here." She grabbed his wrist. This time he didn't pull away. The next flight took forever to climb. Solo stopped several times to lean on the railing and gaze senselessly at the next step. There was fresh blood trickling down his neck. Juliet stomped her frozen feet some more and cursed to herself. This was all stupid. She'd been so damned stupid. A few steps from the next landing, she left Solo behind and went to check the doors to the farms. The jury-rigged power cables descending from IT and snaking their way inside were a legacy from decades ago, a time when the survivors, like Solo, were cobbling together what they could to stave off their demise. Juliet peeked inside and saw that the grow lights were off. "Solo, I'm gonna go hit the timers. You rest here." He didn't answer. Juliet held the door open and tried to slot her knife into the metal grating by her feet, leaving the handle to prop it open. Her arm shook so violently, it took her considerable effort just to aim it into a gap. Her undersuit, she noticed, smelled like burning rubber, like the smoke from the fire.
"Here,"
Solo said. He held the door open and slumped down against it, pinning it to the railing. Juliet clutched the knife against her chest.
"Thanks."
He nodded and waved his hand. His eyes drooped shut.
"Water,"
he said, licking his lips. She patted his shoulder. "I'll be right back." The farm's entrance hall gobbled up the emergency lights from the stairway, the dim green quickly fading to pitch black. A circulating pump whirred in the distance, the same noise that had greeted her in the upper farm so many weeks ago. But now she knew what the sound was, knew there would be water available. Water and food, perhaps a change of clothes. She just needed to get the lights on so she could see. She cursed herself for not bringing a spare flashlight, for the loss of her pack and their gear. The darkness accepted her as she climbed over the security gate. She knew her way. These farms had been nourishing her and Solo for weeks while they worked on the pathetic hydroponics pump and all that plumbing. Juliet thought of the new pump she'd wired. The mechanic in her was curious about the connection, wondered whether the thing would work, if she should have thrown the switch on the landing before they left. It was a crazy thought, but even if she didn't live to see it, some part of her wanted that silo dry, that flood removed. Her ordeal in its depths already seemed oddly distant, like something she had seen in a dream but hadn't really gone through. And yet she wanted it to have mattered for something. She wanted Solo's wounds to have mattered for something. Her undersuit swished noisily while she walked, her legs rubbing together, her damp feet squeaking as she lifted them from the floor. She kept one hand on the wall, her knife comforting her in the other. Already she could feel the residual warmth in the air from the last burn of the grow lights. She was thankful to be out of that frigid stairwell. In fact, she felt better. Her eyes began to adjust to the darkness. She would get some food, some water, find them a safe place to sleep. Tomorrow they would aim for the MID's deputy station. They could arm themselves, gather their strength. Solo would be stronger by then. She would need him to be. At the end of the hall, Juliet groped for the doorway to the control room. Her hand habitually went to the switch inside, but it was already up. It hadn't worked in over 3 decades. She fumbled blindly through the room, arms out in front of her, expecting to hit the wall long before she did. The tip of the knife scraped one of the control boxes. Juliet reached up to find the wire hanging from the ceiling, tacked up by someone long ago. She traced the wire to the timer it had been rigged to, felt for the programmable knob, and slowly turned it until it clicked. A series of loud pops from the relays outside rattled down the growing halls. A dim glow appeared. It would take a few minutes for them to warm all the way up. Juliet left the control room and headed down one of the overgrown walkways railed off between the long plots of dirt. The nearest plots were picked clean. She pushed through the greenery, plants from either side of the hall shaking hands in the middle, and made her way to the circulation pump. Water for Solo, warmth for herself. She repeated this mantra, begging the lights to heat up faster. The air around her remained dim and hazy, like the view of an outside morning beneath the heavy clouds. She made her way through the pea plants, long neglected. Popping a few pods off their vines, she gave her stomach something to do besides ache. The pump whirred louder as it worked to push water through the drip pipes. Juliet chewed a pea, swallowed, slipped through the railing, and made her way to the small clearing around the pump. The soil beneath the pump was dark and packed flat from weeks of her and Solo drinking there and refilling their containers. A few cups were scattered on the ground. Juliet knelt beside the pump and chose a tall glass. The lights above her were slowly brightening. She already imagined she could feel their warmth. With a bit of effort, she managed to loosen the drain plug at the bottom of the pump a few turns. The water was under pressure and jetted out in a fine spray. She held the cup tightly against the pump to minimize the spillage. The cup gurgled as it was filled. She drank out of one cup while filling another, some loose dirt crunching between her teeth. Once both were full, she screwed them into the wet dirt so they wouldn't tip over, and then twisted the plug until the spray stopped. Juliet tucked the knife under her arm and grabbed the two cups. She went to the railing, passed everything through, and threw her leg over the lowermost bar and scrambled out. Now she needed warmth. She left the cups where they were and grabbed the knife. There were offices around the corner, a dining room. She remembered her first outfit in Silo 17, a tablecloth with a slit in the middle. She laughed to herself as she turned the corner, feeling like she was regressing, like her weeks of working to make things better were taking her back to where she'd started. The long hallway between the two grow stations was dark. A handful of wires hung from the pipes overhead, drooping between the spots where they'd been hastily attached. They marched in these upside-down leaps toward the hum and glow of the growing plots in the distance. Juliet checked the offices and found nothing for warmth. No overalls, no curtains. She moved toward the dining hall, was turning to enter, when she thought she heard something beyond the next plot of plants. A click, a crackle. More relays for the lights? Stuck, perhaps? She peered down the hall and into the grow station beyond. The lights were brighter there, warming up. Maybe they'd come on sooner. She crept down the hallway toward them, drawn like a shivering fly to a flame, her arms bursting with goosebumps at the thought of drying out, of getting truly warm. At the edge of the station, she heard something else. A squeal, maybe metal on metal, possibly another circulation pump trying to kick over. She and Solo hadn't checked the other pumps on this level. There was more than two people could eat or drink in the first patches. Juliet froze and turned around to look behind herself. Where would she set up camp if she were trying to survive in this place? In IT, for the power? Or here, for the food and water? She imagined another man like Solo squeezing through the cracks in the violence, lying low and surviving the long years. Maybe he'd heard the air compressor earlier, had come down to investigate, got scared, hit Solo over the head, and ran. Maybe he grabbed their gear bag just because it was there, or maybe it had been knocked under the railing by accident and had sunk to the pits of mechanical. She held the knife out in front of herself and slid down the hallway between the burgeoning plants. The wall of green before her parted with a rustle as she pushed through. Things were more overgrown here, unwelcoming, not picked over. This filled her with a mix of emotions. She was probably wrong, was probably hearing things again, just as she had for weeks, but part of her wanted to be right. She wanted to find this man who was like Solo. She wanted to make contact. Better that than living in fear of someone lurking in every shadow, behind every corner. But what if there was more than one of them? Could a group of people have survived this long? How many could there be and go undetected? The silo was a massive place, but she and Solo had spent weeks in the down deep, had been in and out of these farms several times. Two people, an oldish couple, no more. Solo had said the man was his age. He would have to be. His calculations and more ran through her mind, convincing her that she had nothing to be afraid of. She was shivering, but her adrenaline was pumping. She was armed. The leaves of wild and unkempt plants brushed against her face. Juliet pushed through this dense outer barrier and knew she'd found something on the other side. The farms here were different. Groomed, tamed, recently guided by the hand of man. Juliet felt a wash of fear and relief, those two opposites twisting together like staircase and rail. She didn't want to be alone, didn't want this silo to be so desolate and empty, but she didn't want to be attacked. The first part of her felt an urge to call out, to tell whoever was in there that she meant no harm. The second part tightened its grip on the knife, clenched chattering teeth together, and begged her to turn and run. At the end of the groomed grow station, the hallway took a dark turn. She peered around the corner into more unexplored territory. A long patch of darkness stretched toward the other side of the silo, a distant glow of light emanating from what was probably yet another crop station sucking juice from IT. Someone was here. She knew it. She could feel the same eyes she'd felt for weeks, could sense the whispers on her skin, but this time she wasn't imagining it. She didn't have to fight the awareness or think she was going crazy. With her knife at the ready, and the welcomed thought that she was between this someone and the defenseless Solo, she moved slowly but bravely into the dark hall, passing open offices and tasting rooms to either side, one hand on the wall to guide and steady herself. Juliet stopped. Something wasn't right. Had she heard something? A person crying? She backed up to the previous door, could barely see it in front of herself, and realized it was closed. The only one she could see along the hall that was closed. She stepped away from the door and knelt down. There had been a noise inside, she was sure of it, almost like a faint wail. Looking up, she saw in the wan light that some of the overhead wires diverted perpendicularly from the rest and snaked through the wall above the door. Juliet moved closer. She crouched down and put her ear to the door. Nothing. She reached up and tried the knob, felt that it was locked. How could it be locked unless... The door flew open, her hand still on the knob, yanking her into the darkened room. There was a flash of light, and then a man over her, swinging something at her head. Juliet fell onto her ass. A silver blur moved past her face, the crunch of a heavy wrench slamming into her shoulder, knocking her flat. There was a high-pitched scream from the back of the room, drowning out Juliet's cry of pain. She swung the knife out in front of her, felt it hit the man's leg. The wrench clattered to the ground, more screams, people shouting. Juliet kicked away from the door and stood, clutching her shoulder. She was ready for the man to pounce, but her attacker was backing away, limping on one foot. A boy, no more than 14, maybe 15. "Stay where you are," Juliet aimed the knife at him. The boy's eyes were wide with fear. A group of kids huddled against the back wall on a scattering of mattresses and blankets. They clung to one another, their wide eyes aimed at Juliet. The confusion was overwhelming. She was seized by the sensation of wrongness. Where were the others? The adults? She could feel people with bad intentions sliding down the dark hallway behind her, ready to pounce. Here were their kids, locked away for safety. Soon the mother rats would be back to punish her for disturbing their nest. Where are the others? She asked, her hand trembling from the cold, the confusion, the fear. She scanned the room and saw that the boy standing, the one who had attacked her, was the oldest. A girl in her teens sat frozen on the tangle of blankets, two young boys and a young girl clinging to her. The eldest boy glanced down at his leg. A stain of blood was spreading across his green overalls. How many are there? She took a step closer. These kids were obviously more afraid of her than she was of them. Leave us alone! The older girl screamed. She clutched something to her chest. The young girl beside her pressed her face into the older girl's lap, trying to disappear. The two young boys glared like cornered dogs, but didn't move. How did you get here? She asked them. She aimed the knife at the tall boy, but started to feel silly for wielding it. He looked at her in confusion, not comprehending the question, and Juliet knew. Of course. How would there be decades of fighting in the silo without that second human passion? You were born down here, weren't you? Nobody answered. The boy's face screwed up in confusion, as if the question were mad. She peeked back over her shoulder. Where are your parents? When will they be back? How long?
Never!
The girl screeched, her head straining forward from the effort.
They're dead!
Her mouth remained open, her chin trembling. The tendons stood out on her young neck. The older boy turned and glared at the girl, seemed to want her to remain quiet. Juliet was still trying to comprehend that these were mere kids. She knew they couldn't be alone. Someone had attacked Solo. As if to answer, her eyes were drawn to the wrench on the decking. It was Solo's wrench. The rust stains were distinctive. How was that possible? Solo had said, and Juliet remembered what he'd said. She realized these kids, this young man, were the same age that he still saw himself as, the same age he'd been when he'd been left alone. Had the last survivors of the Down Deep perished in recent years, but not before leaving something behind? What's your name? Juliet asked the boy. She lowered her knife and showed him her other palm. My name's Juliet, she said. She wanted to add that she came from another silo, a saner world, but didn't want to confuse them or freak them out.
Rickson, the boy snarled. He puffed out his chest. My father was Rick the Plumber.
Rick the Plumber? Juliet nodded. She saw along one wall, at the end of a tall dune of supplies and scavenges, the gear bag they'd stolen. Her change of clothes spilled out the gaping mouth of the bag. Her towel would be in there. She slid toward the bag, an eye on the kids huddled together on the makeshift bed, the group nest, wary of the older boy.
Well, Rickson, I want you to gather your things.
Kneeling by her bag, she dug inside and searched for the towel. She found it, pulled it out, and rubbed it over her damp hair. An indescribable luxury. There was no way she was leaving them here, these kids. She turned to face the other children, the towel draped across the back of her neck, their eyes all locked on hers.
Go ahead, she said. Get your things together. You're not going to live like this.
Just leave us,
the older girl said. The two boys had moved off the bed, though, and were going through piles of things. They looked to the girl, then to Juliet, unsure.
Go back to where you're from,
Rickson said. The two eldest children seemed to be gaining strength from each other.
Take your noise machines and go.
That's what this was about. Juliet remembered the sight of the compressor on its side, more heavily attacked, maybe, than Solo had been. She nodded to the two smaller boys, had their ages pegged for 10 or 11.
Go on, she told them. You're going to help me and my friend get home. We have good food there, real electricity, hot water. Get your things.
The youngest girl cried out at this, a horrible peal, the same cry Juliet had heard from the dark hallway. Rickson paced back and forth, eyeing her in the wrench on the floor. Juliet slid away from him and toward the bed to comfort the young girl, when she realized it wasn't her squealing. Something moved in the older girl's arms. Juliet froze at the edge of the bed.
No,
she whispered. Rickson took a step toward her.
Stay!
She aimed the point of the knife at him. He glanced down at the wound on his leg, thought better of it. The two boys froze in the act of stuffing their bags. Nothing in the room moved, save the baby squealing and fidgeting in the girl's arms. "Is that a child?" The girl turned her shoulders. It was a motherly gesture, but the girl couldn't have been more than 15. Juliet didn't know that was possible. She wondered if that was why the implants went in so early. Her hand slid toward her hip, almost as if to touch the place, to rub the bump beneath her skin.
"Just go," the teenager whimpered. "We've been fine without you."
Juliet put down the knife. It felt strange to relinquish it, but more wrong to have it in her hand as she approached the bed.
"I can help you," she said.
She turned and made sure the boy heard her.
"I used to work in a place that cared for newborns. Let me."
She reached out her hands. The girl turned further toward the wall, shielding the child from her.
"Okay."
Juliet held up her hands, showed her palms.
"But you're not going to live like this anymore."
She nodded to the young boys, turned to Rickson, who hadn't moved.
"None of you are. This isn't how anyone should have to live their days, not even their last ones."
She nodded to herself, her mind made up. "Rickson, get your things together. Only the necessities. We'll come back for anything else." She dipped her chin at the younger boys, saw how their overalls had been chopped at the knees, their legs covered in grime from the farms. They took it as permission to return to packing. These two seemed eager to have someone else in charge, maybe anybody other than their brother, if that's who he was.
"Tell me your name."
Juliet sat down on the bed with the two girls while the others rummaged through their things. She fought to remain calm, not to succumb to the nausea of kids having kids. The baby let out a hungry cry.
"I'm here to help you," Juliet told the girl. "Can I see? Is it a girl or a boy?"
The young mother relaxed her arms. A blanket was folded away, revealing the squinting eyes and pursed red lips of a baby no more than a few months old. A tiny arm waved at its mother.
"Girl," she said softly.
The younger girl clinging to her side peeked around the mother's ribs at Juliet.
"Have you given her a name?"
She shook her head.
"Not yet."
Rickson said something behind her to the two boys, trying to get them not to fight over something.
"My name's Elise," the younger girl said,
her head emerging from behind the other girl's side. Elise pointed at her mouth.
"I have a loose tooth."
Juliet laughed. "I can help you with that if you like." She took a chance and reached out to squeeze the young girl's arm. Flashes of her childhood and her father's nursery flooded back, the memories of worried parents, of precious children, of all the hopes and dreams created and dashed around that lottery. Juliet's thoughts swerved to her brother, the one who was not meant to be, and she felt the tears well up in her eyes. What had these kids been through? Solo at least had normal experiences from before. He knew what it meant to live in a world where one could be safe. What had these five kids, six, grown up in, seen? She felt such intense pity for them, pity that verged on the sick, wrong, sad desire for none of them to have ever been born, which was just as soon washed over with a wave of guilt for even considering it.
"We're going to get you out of here," she told the two girls. "Gather your things."
One of the young boys came over and dropped her bag nearby. He was putting things back into it, apologizing to her, when Juliet heard another strange squeak.
"What now?"
She dabbed her mouth in the towel, watching as the girls reluctantly did an adult's bidding, finding their things and eyeing one another to make sure this was okay. Juliet heard a rustling in her gear bag. She used the handle to separate the zippered mouth, wary of what could be living in the rat's nest these kids had created, when she heard a tiny voice calling her name. She dropped the towel and clawed through the bag, past tools and bottles of water, under her spare overalls and loose socks, until she found the radio. She wondered how Solo could possibly be calling her. The other set had been ruined in her suit.
"Please say something,"
the radio hissed.
"Juliet, are you there? It's Walker. Please, for God's sake, answer me."
75. Silo 18.
"What happened? Why aren't they responding?"
Courtney looked from Walker to Shirley, as if either of them could know.
"Is it broken?"
Shirley picked up the small dial with the painted marks and tried to tell if it had accidentally moved.
"Walk, did we break it?"
"No, it's still on," he said.
He held the headphones up by his cheek, his eyes drifting over the various components.
"Guys, I don't know how much longer we have."
Courtney was watching the scene in the generator room through the observation window. Shirley stood up and peered out over the control panel toward the main entrance. Jenkins and some of his men were inside, rifles pinned against their shoulders, yelling at the others. The soundproofing made it impossible to hear what was going on.
Hello?
A voice crackled from Walker's hands. The words seemed to tumble through his fingers.
Who's there?
He called, flicking the switch.
Who is this?
Shirley rushed to Walker's side. She wrapped her hands around his arm, disbelieving.
Juliet! She screamed.
Walker held up his hand, tried to quiet her and Courtney both. His hands were trembling as he fumbled with the detonator and finally clicked the red switch.
Jules?
His old voice cracked. Shirley squeezed his arm.
Is that you?
There was a pause, and then a cry from the speakers, a sob.
Walk! Walk, is that you? What's going on? Where are you? I thought...
Where is she? Shirley whispered. Courtney watched them both, her cheeks in her palms, mouth open. Walker hit the switch.
Jules, where are you?
A deep sigh hissed through the tiny speakers. Her voice was tiny and far away.
Walk, I'm in another silo. There's more of them. You wouldn't believe.
Her voice drifted off to static. Shirley leaned against Walker while Courtney paced in front of them, looking from the radio to the window.
May know about the others,
Walker said, holding the mic below his beard.
We can hear them, Jules. All of them.
He let go of the switch. Juliet's voice returned.
How are you? Mechanical? I heard about the fighting. Are you in the middle of that?
Before she signed off, Juliet said something to someone else, her voice barely audible. Walker raised his eyebrows at the mention of the fighting.
How would she have heard?
Shirley asked.
I wish she were here, Courtney said. Jules would know what to do. Tell her about the exhaust, about the plan.
Shirley waved for the microphone.
Here, let me.
Walker nodded. He handed Shirley the headset and the detonator. Shirley worked the switch. It was stiffer than she'd thought it'd be.
Jules, can you hear me? It's Shirley. Shirley,
Juliet's voice wavered.
Hey, you. You hanging in there?
The emotion in her friend's voice brought tears to Shirley's eyes.
Yeah.
She bobbed her head and swallowed.
Hey, listen, some of the others are routing the exhaust feed to IT's cooling vents. But remember that time we lost back pressure? I'm worried the motor might...
No, Juliet said.
You have to stop them. Shirley, can you hear me? You have to stop them. It won't do anything. The cooling is for the servers, the only people up there who...
She cleared her throat.
Listen to me. Make them stop.
Shirley fumbled with the red switch. Walker reached over as if to help, but she finally got the device under control.
Wait, she transmitted. How do you know where the vents lead? I just do. This place is laid out the same. God damn it, let me talk to them. You can't let them...
Shirley hit the switch again. There was a blast of sound from the generator room as Courtney threw open the door and ran outside.
Courtney's going, she said. She's going right now. Jules, how did you... Who are you with? Can they help us? It's not looking good over here.
The tiny speakers crackled again. Shirley could hear Juliet take a deep breath, could hear other voices in the background, heard her give commands or orders to some other person. Shirley thought her friend sounded exhausted, weary, sad.
There's nothing I can do, Juliet said. There's no one here. One man, some kids. Everyone's gone. The people who lived here, they couldn't even help themselves.
The line went silent, and then she clicked through again.
You have to stop the fighting, she said. Whatever it takes, please, don't let it be because of me. Please stop.
The door opened again, Courtney returning. Shirley heard shouts in the generator room. Gunfire.
What is that? Juliet asked. Where are you guys? In the control room.
Shirley looked up at Courtney, whose eyes were wide with fear.
Jules, I don't think we have much time.
There was so much she wanted to say. She wanted to tell her about Mark. She needed more time.
They're coming for us, was all she could think to relate. I'm glad you're okay.
The radio crackled.
Oh God, make them stop. No more fighting. Shirley, listen to me. It doesn't matter, Shirley said, holding the button and wiping her cheeks. They won't stop.
The gunfire was getting closer, the pops audible through the thick door. Her people were dying while she cowered in the control room, talking to a ghost. Her people were dying.
You take care of yourself, Shirley said.
Wait! Shirley handed the headset to Walker. She joined Courtney by the window and watched the crush of people cower on the other side of the generator. The flash and shudder of barrels leaning against the railing. Someone in the blue of mechanical lying still on the ground. More faded pops, more distant and muted rattles.
Jules,
Walker fumbled with the radio. He shouted her name, was still trying to talk to her.
Let me talk to them, Juliet yelled, her voice impossibly far away. Walk, why can I hear you and not them? I need to talk to the deputies, to Peter and Hank.